Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Cuppins.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And today our special guest is Chris Carter, who is a person who has written a very big book called Science and the Near-Death Experience, How Consciousness Survives Death. And it's a new take on the entire near-death experience. As we know, most of the near-death books are quite often done either by the skeptics or by doctors. But Chris is somebody who's basically standing on the outside looking in. So, Chris, you have written a previous book which is called Parapsychology and the Skeptics. Can you kind of map your way as to how you got involved with parapsychology and also why specifically you focused on the near-death experience?
Well, I've always been interested in controversial topics in science and philosophy. I've trained in both science and philosophy. I have 2 degrees from the University of Oxford. And, the reason why I'm specifically interested in writing about parapsychological topics was because of a lengthy debate I had with a very stubborn and dogmatic skeptic several years ago. Frankly, I was shocked by his ignorance and by the crudity of his arguments. So I decided that a book, or actually it turned out 3 books, were necessary to examine the evidence that the mind can function independently of the brain.
So your first book was Parapsychology and the Skeptics, correct?
That's right.
And what did you explore in that book?
The first book, in the 3-part trilogy, basically examined the evidence for psychic abilities such as telepathy and precognition. It examined all of the objections from the leading skeptics such as Richard Wiseman, Susan Blackmore, Ray Hyman, James Randi, and several others. It discussed the philosophy of science, the nature of science, and basically showed that there is strong experimental evidence for the existence of these abilities, and also that absolutely nothing in modern science would be compromised by the existence of these abilities.
Chris, why do you think, I realize that skeptics are skeptics, and we deal with them in our own work all the time, but why do you think people are so afraid of this? I mean, don't you think, first of all, that a lot of the skeptical point of view comes from fear? I guess that's the first question. Do you believe that the skeptical perspective is somehow rooted in fear or fear-based? And if that is the case, what are they so afraid of?
Well, you're right. Several skeptics have expressed a fear of the reality of psi. Susan Blackmore has. The recently deceased skeptical psychologist Elizabeth Meyer expressed a fear of psi. I don't think that all of the skeptics go around, you know, with a terror of, oh, what if psi is real? Essentially, as I argue in my first book, this debate is primarily not about evidence. The debunkers and the deniers are defending an outmoded worldview in which psychic phenomena are simply not allowed to exist. It's essential to realize that most of the deniers and phony skeptics are militant atheists and secular humanists. So for various reasons, these people have an ideological agenda, which is anti-religious and anti-superstitious. One of the pillars of their opposition to religion and superstition is the ancient doctrine of materialism. That is the doctrine that all events have a physical cause and that the brain therefore produces the body. Now, if they conceded the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy, and if they conceded the existence of the near-death experience as a genuine separation of mind from body, then this pillar of their opposition would crumble, hence their dogmatic denial of the evidence that proves materialism false. So what they're essentially afraid of is a challenge to their deeply held worldview based upon materialism, and also they're afraid that open the door a crack, religion, prayer in schools, the Inquisition, and so forth are all going to make a comeback.
So essentially they lump it all together, everything, whether it's the Inquisition and religion or parapsychology, they lump it all together in one superstitious mass.
Well, basically, they're essentially defending their worldview, and because their worldview is threatened by the existence of psychic abilities and by the the existence of the near-death experience as a separation of mind from body. Their entire atheistic worldview is based upon the ancient doctrine of materialism. And according to materialism, these things cannot be what they appear to be. If they accepted that these things are real, then, as I said before, one of the pillars of their opposition to religion would crumble. So they're afraid for personal reasons, and they're also afraid of the effects of religion.
What I find interesting in this topic is always the fact that somehow that the existence of paranormal abilities or phenomenon or the near-death experience somehow is a threat to the atheist, as somehow as if this is religion or evidence of God. How do you stand on that, and how do you think that those two kind of like almost go hand in hand?
Yeah, exactly. If they admit to the existence of psychic abilities, then this foundation, the foundation of their worldview, will crumble. And so they fear that the basis of their opposition to religion and superstition will be gone. But I think their fears are absolutely groundless. Surveys show that most scientists accept the likely existence of psychic abilities. And also, surveys show that scientists enjoy considerable prestige among the general public. So society is unlikely to return to the Dark Ages anytime soon.
So in your second book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, you explore the near-death phenomenon. And basically from kind of like I think where everybody is that in the 1970s, some doctors began to study these reports of people who had near-death experiences and catalogued them. Definitely in Britain right now, you have Dr. Samparnia, who had some exposure on television with the experiments he did. What is the story of near-death experience? Where are we? Where is science? Where is the parascience? What's the argument? Where are we?
Well, where are we? There's been an awful lot of research into the near-death experience since the 1970s. Some of the evidence gathered is extremely impressive. Some of the cases themselves, I mean, are extremely impressive. And I think that, as I discuss in my book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, I think that the evidence basically falsifies the ancient doctrine of materialism. That is, the doctrine that the brain, that all events have a physical cause, and that the brain, therefore, produces the mind. I think that, on the contrary, the evidence that we now have indicates that the brain works as a two-way receiver-transmitter, sometimes from body to mind, as in sense perception, and other times from mind to body, as in willed action. The rival hypothesis, that the brain produces the mind, I believe has been proven conclusively false by the data. And this evidence is examined in great detail in my new book.
One of the premises of the skeptical point of view is that memory exists in the brain. And when the brain is dead, there is nowhere for it to go, and therefore, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. And that's one of the things that you explore in this book. And I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about disproving that idea.
Yeah, sure. Well, the idea that memories are stored in the brain dates back at least to Aristotle. He used the analogy of impressions and wax. And, of course, the analogy has been updated to electronic recording devices and so forth. And scientists, neuroscientists, for decades have tried to locate memories inside of animal brains. What they've done is they've taught an animal, say a mouse or an octopus or what have you, some new task. And then they basically remove sections of the poor animal's brain and then test the animal again to see if it remembers the task. And what they found is that they, no matter what parts of the brain they cut out, if the animal is still living and is still functioning properly, the animal still remembers how to do the task. So in other words, brain scientists have utterly failed to locate memories, where memories might be stored within the animal brain. It's also true in the case of human beings. Of course, they don't do such experiments with people, but people have obviously brain lesions, brain injuries, and sometimes it affects certain of their memories. Sometimes they can't even remember who they're married to or where they live. But what they find is that these memories seem to return over time. They're not permanently destroyed. They're only temporarily incapacitated. So The attempt to locate memories in the brain, in other words, has completely failed. They just cannot do it, and they're left with the unfalsifiable and therefore unscientific hypothesis that memories are somehow stored everywhere in the brain. So in other words, there is simply no evidence whatsoever that memories are stored in the brain. In my book, I discuss the theories of other people, other biologists and brain scientists, as to then where are memories stored? How do we access our memories? In particular, I address the work of biologist Rupert Sheldrake. He's written a number of books, such as The Presence of the Past, and he argues that there's a ridiculously simple reason why brain scientists cannot find the location of memories in the brain. The reason is they just don't exist. He argues that the brain tunes into memories. I don't want to go into too much detail here, because it's rather technical, but essentially he argues for of morphogenetic fields, which essentially are a new type of field as yet unrecognized by physics. And these are associated with the growth and development of organisms and with our mental capacities. So he argues that memories may have an extra cerebral location outside of the brain in the form of these morphogenetic fields.
So does that mean that somehow those morphogenetic fields are responsible for surviving physical death, or how do you see that?
Well, it's difficult to say. If memories are stored outside of the brain, the brain simply tunes into these memories, then it may be that if we survive death, then the brain is still capable of tuning into its own morphogenetic... the surviving mind is still capable of tuning into its morphogenetic fields. It may be that the mind is partly composed of morphogenetic fields. In my book, I discuss several theories of mind-body interaction that have been developed by various modern physicists using, the ideas of quantum mechanics. So there are theories about how the mind and the brain interact. The precise details at this point remain somewhat largely a matter of speculation.
And that seems to be kind of the overall principle, isn't it? When I look at your book, there's clearly a fact that people like Susan Blackmore are trying to explain away some of the evidence. They're trying to come up with chemical or electrical phenomena in the brain.
Oxygen deprivation or what have you.
And does all of that interact? Kind of like, you know, like when I look at your book, I see a mass of material. And where do we go? Do we really go into the direction of saying the brain is completely different than what we're thinking of right now, and we should look at it from like the Rupert Sheldrake research? Or does it all interact? Are there chemical components somehow to do with which trigger these events?
As I said before, I think that the evidence clearly shows that the brain works as a receiver transmitter for the mind. It receives from the mind. The brain receives from the mind in willed action, such as the desire to raise your hand, and it transmits to the mind, as in for feeling of stick your hand into a fire. So I think the evidence indicates that it's a fact that the brain works as a the brain works as a two-way receiver transmitter for the mind. Precisely how it does this is another question. I mean, it's kind of, you know, we all know the sun shines, but precisely how and why does it shine? So, and the how and why of how the brain and mind interact is the responsibility of some of the theories of mind-brain interaction that I discussed a few minutes ago, the quantum mechanical theories, which may also relate to the theories of Rupert Sheldrake. Also, in my book, I discuss virtually all of the materialistic counter-explanations for the near-death experience. You know, oxygen deprivation, an excess of carbon dioxide, temporal lobe seizures in the brain and so forth. And I think I find that absolutely none of them adequately explain the near-death experience.
Well, one of the things that I was really struck by in the book, and I found really, really interesting and really compelling, was how you've done the research about near-death experiences across cultures and throughout history. And these, like, the comparisons between how the different cultures at different times, what those near-death experiences look like, how they materialize. You talk about China, about an earthquake that happens in 1976 in China, and how many of those people, I think it was roughly 40%, reported that they had near-death experiences. I was wondering if you could talk about any of the specific cases, either China or India, or some of the things you talk about in your book, so that our listeners could hear a little bit about it, or talk about the comparison of how the near-death experiences compare across these cultural divides.
Yeah, well, in my books, my new book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, I have a whole chapter that deals with the near-death experience across cultures. As you said, reports from China, India, and also from tribal societies such as the Maori and Native American. The main similarities across reports from different cultures appear to be out-of-body experiences and encounters with otherworldly realms and their inhabitants. The life review and the tunnel appear to be culturally specific to the West. Life reviews seem to be found in Western Chinese and East Indian experiences. They're not reported in accounts from societies or hunter-gatherers.
So this whole idea of heading to the light, and by the way, I will intervene here and say I have had a near-death experience, which is one of the reasons I'm very fascinated by this subject. We've talked about it from sort of personal and spiritual perspectives on the show before, and it always gets a tremendous response. It is a subject that I know that certainly our listeners and readers are completely fascinated and really interested in. I know that as soon as we started talking about it, we started getting inundated with mail from people who said, "Oh, I've had this," or "I know someone who has." My particular experience was a being experience. I was confronted with a being who had a discussion with me. It wasn't exactly a life review, but it was something like that. I just wanted to hear you talk a little bit more about the way that these manifest. Like, what does a life review look like in the people that you've interviewed or in the research that you've looked at?
Okay, well, the life review is one of the major components of the near-death experience, but not everyone who has a near-death experience has a life review, and again, they don't seem to be reported from societies of hunters and gatherers, the Maori and the Native American. Life review can take different forms when it does occur. It can take the form of sort of a panoramic, all-at-once view of one's life, which is difficult to explain, or it can take the form of a playback of the major incidences in a person's life. The most interesting ones, I think, the most interesting life reviews are those in which the person experiences a playback of some of the major events in their life, and they experience it from the other person's perspective. So if they did something kind to a person, they'd experience that person's happiness. If they did something cruel, they'd experience that person's misery. And, you know, it seems to be almost a learning experience.
And what about being encounters? Can you tell us some stories of how people have had beings? Were they angelic encounters? Were they ancestors? Were they passed on loved ones? All of the above?
Yes, again, no two near-death experiences are exactly alike. But encounters with otherworldly beings are fairly frequently reported, usually with deceased relatives and deceased friends. I would say that would be the most common. The second would probably be encounters with otherworldly beings who are often simply not identified. They just seem to be either strangers or somewhat other, a being of light who seems to ask questions. Occasionally there's been reported encounters with deceased pets. That's fairly common with children. Children also report encounters with strangers, people they just don't recognize, who they may actually identify as a living person. Oh, it was my teacher. Or they may identify it as a religious figure. And occasionally there are reports of encounters with figures from the person's religion.
What's the most dramatic NDE that you are aware of? What's the one that grabbed you and made you go, okay, you know what? This is undeniable. This is something that we all really have to look at. Was there a specific event, a specific story, a specific circumstance that really grabbed you?
Well, I think that one of the most impressive near-death experiences ever recorded was that of Pam Reynolds. She was an American woman, 35 years old, who needed to be operated upon because she had an aneurysm deep within her brain. And the only way to operate on this aneurysm was to basically bring her to the point of clinical death. She had to have her body frozen. She had to have the blood drained from her body. She had to have her heart stopped. In other words, all activity in her brain had to cease. And they did this. And during this operation to remove her aneurysm, she had one of the deepest near-death experiences ever recorded. She recalls leaving her body. She recalls describing events in the operating room fairly accurately, actually. And then she recalls being pulled upwards to another place where she met some of her deceased relatives. She stayed with them for a while, and then she was sent back. She remembers seeing her body lying on the operating table. And then she remembers not wanting to go to her body, but being pushed into it, basically, by her deceased uncle. And waking up shortly afterwards. So there was no question that Pam Reynolds was clinically dead at the time she had her near-death experience. Her surgeons were absolutely astonished by this experience.
I mean, there's an awful lot of evidence. The Pam Reynolds case, doctors, as I said, like Sam Parnia, who are doing little tests with people to kind of like realize that really they are floating outside of their body when they're on the operating table. Dr. Raymond Moody has been doing it since the 1970s. 40 years of doctors and people looking at the near-death experience, a tremendous amount of volume of data. How much more data does there need to be, do you think, or kind of what is stopping this from kind of being commonly accepted as being fact that consciousness does survive death?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question. You have to remember the vast majority of people and the vast majority of scientists are open-minded. I would say the vast majority of people are very willing to accept the evidence that the mind can function independently of the brain. As I said before, the main objections to accepting this come from a small minority of fanatical, militant humanists, militant atheists, and secular humanists. There's an American organization. They used to call themselves Committee for the Scientific. Was it Committee for the Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal? A few years ago, they shortened their name to Committee for. What was it? Committee for Skeptical Investigation or Committee? I can't exactly remember what the acronym stands for, CSI. And they've been trying for about the last, I don't know, since 1970s. They were formed at a meeting of the American Humanist Association in the 1970s. And so they've been trying to influence the media and basically alter public opinion on these subjects. I think that they've utterly failed. Their own surveys show that belief in psychic abilities and so forth has actually increased since the founding of CSI. So, again, most scientists are open-minded. Go ahead.
What I was saying is that when I was reading your book, what I found interesting is you go back into history to people like Plato, and you also touch upon Lazarus. You find that there are near-death experience in the past, and I felt that, you know, like as much as we are depicting ancient Greece as a very rational, very structured, logical kind of society, they didn't really seem to have any problems embracing the near-death experience at all.
No, I don't. Materialism is an ancient doctrine that goes actually back to ancient Greece. It dates at least back to the work of Democritus. But materialism was just thought to be another philosophy. It wasn't accepted by the vast majority of people. I would argue it's not accepted by the vast majority of people today. But it seemed to gain scientific support from the physics of Isaac Newton, basically because Newton's physics seemed to indicate that the physical world was causally closed. In other words, the brain could influence the mind. But there seemed to be no mechanism available within classical physics by which the mind could influence the brain. Newton himself did not believe this. He followed the dualism of René Descartes. He thought, both of them thought that the human mind was outside of the scope of physics. But it was followers of Newton, people such as Diderot and Voltaire, who were writing in the 18th century as part of the movement known as the Enlightenment. These people had an anti-superstitious, anti-religious agenda. And so they used the implications of Newtonian physics to argue against religion and superstition. They were saying that, you know, the brain affects the mind, but the mind doesn't affect the brain. Basically, the mind is the product of the motion of tiny microscopic particles inside the brain. But we now know that classical physics fails drastically at the microscopic level. It does not describe the motion or the behavior of tiny particles at the microscopic level, at the level of molecules and below. That's where quantum mechanics replaces Newtonian mechanics. And in my book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, I describe how many physicists argue that modern physics is essentially dualistic, or at least is very capable of supporting a form of interactive dualism similar to that of René Descartes and accepted by Isaac Newton.
So do you find that quantum physicists are kind of like looking into near-death experiences and parapsychology as a whole because it kind of like fits in with them, or do they tend to stay away from that as well?
There are certainly physicists involved in parapsychological research, mostly having to do with things like psychokinesis, operating at the microscopic level, that sort of thing, influencing radioactive decay and so forth. Most of the research into near-death experiences is actually done these days by cardiologists, because they are often dealing with people who have recovered from massive heart attacks, who have been brought back from clinical death. So it's cardiologists who are at the cutting edge of research into near-death experiences.
Okay, so I don't know if this is a scientific question or a spiritual question or all of the above. I think that they all blend together when we talk about this subject. But if consciousness survives death, and I certainly believe that it does, where does it go? What happens? What's next?
Well, I think that, as I said before, the near-death experience indicates that the mind, under certain conditions, can operate independently of a properly functioning brain. So in other words, a near-death experience seems to be a genuine separation of mind from body. This in itself does not prove beyond all doubt that we survive death. But the near-death experience and deathbed visions, which I also discuss in my book, certainly suggest a continuing afterlife. There have been cases of the near-death experience and deathbed visions in which people report seeing friends or relatives that they did not know were dead, and they expressed genuine surprise. So as to where we go, I don't believe the near-death experience by itself can really answer that. In my third book, which will be due out later this year, I discuss the other forms of evidence for survival, such as children who seem to remember previous lives, reports of apparitions, and probably most dramatic of all, what appears to be communication from the deceased through mediums. And if you want to answer questions like, well, where do we go, you can do one of two things. You can just speculate, or you can actually read what the deceased appear to say when they communicate through mediums. What they appear to, what Frederick, let me backtrack a little bit. There was a psychical researcher who was one of the original founding fathers of the British Society for Psychical Research back in 1882. His name was Frederick Myers, and he did a great deal of work into the survival question, and after he died, a great deal of material was communicated through a medium, which was always signed F.W. Myers. So it appears that Myers may have written entire books postmortemly. At any rate, he addresses the question of where we go. Where we go is essentially the same physical space we occupy now, except we're composed of a form of matter which is much finer than the material world that we're familiar with, and so it effortlessly passes through our world of matter. And this, incidentally, is not as far-fetched as it might seem, because the vast majority of the matter that we see, the vast majority of, for example, a solid table, is simply empty space. So, you know, this is certainly plausible.
Has this journey of research and exploration, as you went into writing these books, and now as you are coming out at the end of your third book, has it changed you personally? Has your own philosophy, as well as your science, but has your own philosophy changed? Has your own point of view as a human on this process changed as you have gone through this journey?
Well, before I sat down and wrote my books, I had already read a great deal of material on these subjects. I had to read a lot more, of course, to write the books, but I had already read a great deal of material. As I said, my motivation for writing these books started with an argument I had a few years ago with a very dogmatic and extreme skeptic, and I already knew quite a bit about the subject at that point in time. So essentially what I had to do over the past several years to write my books was get myself up to speed with all the literature and all the research. So I wouldn't really say that it changed me. I would say that the bigger change was between when I knew almost nothing about the subject and when I started reading up about these subjects, which was shortly after I graduated from university. So yes, it does have an impact on a person's life.
And I mean, you come from a traditional background. So how did you do that transformation? What appealed you? What was the event which got you into this?
What was the event? Well, I suppose when I lived in England, when I was at the University of Oxford, I heard numerous reports of hauntings in some of these various old houses and castles and so forth. So I suppose that's what got me interested in the subject as a whole.
And did you do research into that, or did you just begin to study basically the entire paranormal field?
I basically just went to the library and started checking out books.
And that's definitely kind of, you know, the way you can tell in your book that what you're trying to do is very pragmatic. It's a very pragmatic book, I find. It's not written by a near death experiencer. I assume you never had a near death experience. Is that correct?
That's correct.
You're not a doctor in the sense that you're a cardiologist or somebody else who is involved with this. You are an observer standing on the outside and reporting from the fringes. Have you got a desire to go on the inside, so to speak? Do you feel that somehow you want to transform the current standoff between skeptics and experiences, or do you find that your mission is merely to catalog and write these three books, or do you now feel that actually your mission is beyond this?
Well, I think that all three of my books go far beyond just cataloging the data. I'm, as I said before, I'm part of my formal academic training is in philosophy, all forms of philosophy, philosophy of mind, philosophy of science, philosophy of knowledge. And so essentially, I'm writing the book from a philosophical and scientific perspective. All of my books are written in that perspective, and they're all written for not just scientists and philosophers, but for a general audience as well. I think that my books are very accessible. I'm essentially trying to show people that, well, that there's nothing unscientific about believing in psychic abilities such as telepathy, and there's nothing unscientific in believing in the near-death experience as a genuine separation of mind from body. There's nothing unscientific in believing in life after death of the body. And what I also have shown in my books is that there's nothing scientific about materialism. On the contrary, a scientific theory is a theory that's capable of being tested. Materialism as a scientific theory makes two bold and very admirable predictions. Number one, we will find no good evidence for psychic abilities such as telepathy. And number two, we will find no good evidence for any genuine separation of mind from body. In all of my books, I show that both of these predictions have been, well, they've been contradicted by very, very strong and reliable data. So in other words, materialism as a scientific theory has been proven false. If it's still defended, then it's defended as an ideology, as a belief that has to be true, as a belief that is taken on faith. So what I'm essentially arguing is that these debunkers and deniers are arguing from a faith-based position.
That's very funny.
We don't need, yeah. Some people think that the belief in an afterlife requires faith. I argue in my book, no, that's not true. It's actually a more scientific belief than the materialistic beliefs of the atheists and the secular humanists.
I've always wondered how the skeptics feel when they find themselves confronting their own mortality. What it must feel like to hold those beliefs, you know, so dear and so strong, and then come to a point of wondering, you know, what happens to me when I die? Is it ashes to ashes, dust to dust? Have you ever had any conversations with skeptics about that, about what they feel happens to them once it's over, and if they have any fear of the fact that, from their point of view, there's nothing but this, there is nothing beyond this?
No. My discussions tend to be more, at least to try to keep them on a philosophical and scientific level. I normally don't discuss people's feelings, to be honest with you.
Well, actually, I can actually give you the example of my dad, who is an atheist. Some months ago, we had a discussion about how he said, like, you know, well, I believe that when I die, that nothing will happen. And he took it as granted that simply the belief that you do not believe in anything after death therefore guarantees the fact that there will not be anything after death, which I kind of like felt was, well, you know, that's not necessarily the way it works, Dad. But I do think my dad's perspective of that is quite typical of an atheist, of like, you know, we believe that nothing exists, therefore when we die, nothing will happen. We will just disappear into this void. I was going to ask the question of, you've studied the near-death experiences in this book, you're focusing on various other aspects. If there was one thing, one phenomenon with which you could hit a skeptic in the face and say, this is the best evidence for the fact that there is something to parapsychology, what would that be?
I don't quite understand the question.
Okay, we have evidence of near-death experiences. We have evidence of various other things like reincarnation. We have evidence of ghosts. We have evidence of this and that. Psychic phenomena, telekinesis. If you had to pick one of those phenomena and you would go to a skeptic and try to convince the skeptic that there is something to parapsychology, what would you pick? Would it be near-death experiences, telekinesis, or something else?
Well, if I was speaking to a dogmatic skeptic, I wouldn't start with anything to do with survival of death. I'd probably start with much more mundane phenomena, such as evidence for telepathy. There's a number of interesting work that's been done in this field. I suppose two of the most interesting are the Ganzfeld experiments, which I describe in my first book, Parapsychology and the Skeptics. These are experiments that have been done for the last 20 years, basically involving two people sitting in different rooms, and basically one person is in a sort of meditative state, and the other person is looking at a choice of four different photographs or films and trying to send this image to the person who's in the other room. And then after about 15 minutes, the second person, the receiver, so to speak, is given a choice of four different photographs and asked to choose which one was being transmitted or which one was the sender looking at. And so if chance alone were operating, you'd expect about a success rate of about 25%. Instead, we normally see a success rate of about 33%, about one in every three instead of one in every four. However, with certain subjects, especially artistically gifted people, success rate has been as high as 50, 60%, which is far above chance. And thousands of these experiments have been done all over the world, and when you combine the results, the results far exceed the chance rate of 25%. So the Ganzfeld is very impressive. Oh, some of the work Rupert Sheldrake has done with telephone telepathy has been very impressive. Sheldrake has also done some work with dogs who seem to know when their owners are coming home. Animals, abilities such as telepathy seem to be far more developed in animals than in human beings. Dogs seem to be the most gifted, followed by cats, horses, parrots, with humans trailing far behind. So, yeah, some of the work with telepathy in animals has also been extremely impressive. So I'd start with that. There's a very good book, by the way, called The Conscious Universe by Dean Radin, which is an excellent summary of the evidence for the experimental evidence for telepathy and clairvoyance and so forth.
Absolutely. I mean, actually, when we're talking about psychic dogs, we live in a cul-de-sac. We have a dog and a cat, and what I started to notice was that whenever I'm at home, but Kathleen has gone out with the car, the dog will run to the front window about 2 minutes before Kathleen will actually show up. And there's no way the dog can know that, you know, Kathleen is on the approach. 2 minutes before she arrives, at best she is surrounded by 50 other cars making, you know, like far more noise on a Los Angeles freeway. But the dog goes there and sits there, and, you know, Kathleen's car will show up. So it's a very good early warning system to kind of go out and help with luggage or whatever needs to be, groceries which needs to be brought in. There's lots of, I mean, basically the thing is this, I think, Chris. There's so many stories. There's first-hand reports, hundreds, thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of accounts throughout history, that this is happening, that there is something more to life. And when I looked at books which deal with people who were communicating with death around 1900, in Victorian times in England, you almost find that belief in the afterlife was the common acceptance, even for people who weren't necessarily Christian. So have you got any ideas to where it went within one century from almost everybody believing this to the struggle which you have, which everybody else has, which doctors have, in once again trying to convince the world that even though they accept it, that this is actually kind of like, you know, the norm. This isn't just a matter of interest, but it is really everyday, I wouldn't say reality, but definitely a super reality.
You seem to be implying that a belief in psychic abilities such as telepathy or a belief in the survival of bodily death is somehow uncommon, or the opposite is true. I mean, even among, I mean, surveys have shown that most scientists accept the existence of psychic abilities, such as telepathy, to be either very likely or an established fact. Among the general public, the percentages are even higher. So it's not a minority position by any means. It's, I mean, as I said before, so-called scientific opposition to these things dates back to the so-called Enlightenment, the work of Diderot and Voltaire, who basically had an anti-religious, anti-superstitious agenda. And they had it for a good reason, remember. I mean, you know, at the time they were writing, you know, the mid-18th century, the Inquisition, the wars of religion, the witch hunts and so forth, you know, they were still fresh in people's minds. So they really did have, one could argue, a legitimate bone to pick with the authority of the church and with the existence of some of the local superstitions. And so that's where the, you know, the militant atheist, militant secular humanist origin started, in the Enlightenment, which can be thought of as the ideological aftermath of the scientific revolution. It was based upon Newtonian physics, as I said, but we've known for over a century that Newtonian physics is fundamentally flawed and grossly incorrect. It's been replaced by quantum mechanics. And as I think I also earlier remarked, many physicists, Olivier Coster de Beauregard, David Bohm, the Nobel Prize winner Brian Josephson, and several others have repeatedly claimed that absolutely nothing in modern physics would be compromised by the existence of psychic abilities such as telepathy. So essentially, any opposition, first of all, is a minority position even today, but is based upon an historic conflict between science and religion. And it's also based upon the outmoded science of the 17th and 18th century.
We have been discussing author Chris Carter's book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, How Consciousness Survives Death. Chris, I'm excited about the third book in the trilogy that's coming out. Can you tell us what it's called and when to expect it?
Well, we've only got a working title at this point. The title at this point is Death and Beyond, but that depends upon negotiations with the publisher. It may be changed, so I can't promise that's going to be the title. It'll probably be released sometime at the end of 2011. My second book, Science and the Near-Death Experience, has a section at the back which is a preview of the third book.
Okay. Well, Chris, thank you for being on our show. It's a wonderful book, and I'm very much looking forward to the conclusion of the trilogy. And you constantly have to ask this, is the trilogy at one point going to get a part four?
Not sure at this point. I'll still be writing books and articles. I may be involved with a documentary in 2011, 2012, and there may be a book associated with that documentary. So they'll still be, to answer your question, another book, not sure, but there'll still be written projects and film projects that I'll be working on.
That's wonderful to hear. Chris, thank you very much, and all the best with your future research.
Thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks.
There's a passage in Chris Carter's book that I just wanted to read. It's a very short passage, but I thought it was so beautiful. In part two of his book, which is called The Near-Death Experience, that segment is called The Near-Death Experience, he has this quote, which is from ancient Greece, and it is an explanation of a near-death experience. And I just thought it was so beautiful and so poetic that I wanted to share it with you all. I approached the frontier of death. I saw the threshold of Persephone. I journeyed through all the elements and came back. I saw at midnight the sun sparkling in white light. I came close to the gods of the upper and the nether world and adored them near at hand. I just thought that was absolutely stunning. I thought it was just a really beautiful, poetic element. And I think Chris's book is very scientific, and there's an awful lot of data, a lot of research, an awful lot of theory. So it's lovely to have that sort of an island in the middle of the book, that thing that reminds you that we can quantify this all day long. But for me, at the end of it, I have to go back to What is this? How does this feel to me? What is this about spiritually? So that little piece that he had there in the middle, that piece of Greek poetry about the near-death experience, I thought was extremely powerful.
Well, and a few weeks ago, we were talking about the winter solstice and how there's a tremendous amount of passing. And I definitely remember when my grandfather died, almost 30 years ago now, that at the moment of time when he passed on, I had a very vivid dream. I was literally asleep. To cut a very long story short, I went into his cabinet where he kept his personal possessions, and his clock, his watch, just stopped at 6:37 in the morning. And the very next thing, like the very next second, was the front doorbell ringing. And it was my grandparents' neighbors who came to my mum and said, "You need to come straight away because something has happened to your grandfather." And later during the day, I found out that he had died between 6:35 and 6:40, most likely at the precise moment in time. So there's an enormous amount of beautiful personal material. And I think if one of our listeners or several of our listeners have personal experiences of the near-death experience, write them out on our Facebook page. You don't even have to be on Facebook to go there. It's a public page. You can access it from our website, thespiritrevolution.com. If you want to tell us, either record your own near-death experience, or we can help you get on the show and get it on the show. Because the body of near-death experiences, the personal stories, is what makes this beautiful, is what makes this special.
Oh, no, I totally agree. And one of the things that I was actually really taken by in the course of the interview is the idea of animals and how children who have near-death experiences tend to see animals, and also this idea of the psychic ability of animals. And Philip mentioned it in the interview. Our dog Apollo knows when I'm coming home, even though I'm a mile away down a street in the middle of Los Angeles. He can sense when I am on my way home. And I actually think that that is as much about love as it is about psychic ability. It's a completely different subject. Or is it this idea that love and consciousness and parapsychology all tie in there together? But would Apollo know that somebody else is coming? No, but he knows when I'm coming, and I'm his mommy, and he loves me. So, you know, I think all of that's interesting, and it does tie back to the near-death experience, because we're talking about the idea that so many of us have seen loved ones or ancestors or something like that in our NDEs. And one of the things that, you know, we didn't get a chance to talk to you about too much, so we will do another show on this, and this is why we really want your experiences. We want you to write to us so that we can interview on the show, because I want to talk about if you've ever had a life review experience. I want to talk about if you've had a being encounter. I had a being encounter in my near-death experience, in that I encountered a red-haired woman who had very strong words for me. And those words were, you don't get to do this yet. You've got to go back. And for me, it's also fascinating how many people have that experience of being told by a loved one, you have to go back. You don't get to pass yet. Your time on earth is not done. So we'd love to explore some of these things with you all on a personal level. And we really want to hear from you if you've had any experiences like this.
Absolutely. And just as a quick add-on, it's about the animals. You know, immediately what comes to mind is the fact that in the afterlife, and specifically from a shamanic point of view, you have the spirit animal, the animal with which you identify. And definitely in the Western world, if not the entire world as a whole, the animals which are closest to us right now is a dog and a cat. Obviously, if you live in the wild, before domestication of an awful lot of animals, you'll find that there are other spirit guides. But even for the ancient Egyptians, it was the dog who was such a powerful reminder and an opener of ways of going into the afterworld. And definitely, once again, the ancient Egyptians, they always identified their deities with animals as well. And when you look at the extraordinary amount of stories about how dogs are now able to predict epileptic seizures, how dogs will not leave their owner or their loved one when they go through certain things, when dogs do this and that, you definitely realize that these are extremely sentient beings who are very much capable of far more than once again traditional science is giving them at this moment in time. With that in mind, we are at the end of another spirit revolution. It's the first of the new year, and we therefore are wishing you all the best wishes for 2011. We will continue to do the spirit revolution in 2011.
Absolutely. 2011 is all about finding new spirit, finding new revolutionaries, and the truth against the world.